Broadcasting from Manhattan Beach and the World Wide Web, you're listening to CHSR, HealthyLife.net.
As a service to our listeners, this program is for general information and entertainment purposes only. CHSRHealthyLife.net does not recommend, endorse, or object to the views, products, or topics expressed or discussed by show hosts or their guests. We suggest you always consult with your own personal, medical, financial, or legal advisor.
Welcome to HealthyLife.net's Visionary Celebrity Series, a place where you get to call in and talk live to a world-renowned expert. Today's show is Mind Health Matters with Dr. Bernie Siegel, a world-renowned expert on mind-body medicine and patient empowerment. So let's welcome Dr. Bernie Siegel.
Hello. I'm flattered by my introduction. I sound like a pretty good guy. But lately, I am now age 91. I can't help it. And, you know, there are times when you're 91, you think about, would I be better off just leaving my body? My body's in pretty damn good shape at 91. Trying to think. I don't really take any medications for diseases or anything else. Well, I shouldn't say that. I mean, yes, when my wife died, my heart went a little nuts. You know, I had a broken heart. So I'm on some medications now for my heart. But other than that, my body's in good shape. But, you know, it's like, what do you devote yourself to? And years ago, what really changed me, that's why I get in the mood and the strength that I write one more book. I don't know if I can do it, but we'll see. I don't write them. I dictate them. I'm not good at writing. See, that was the funny thing to start with. The only C I got in 4 years of college was in creative writing. I ended up writing a New York Times bestseller, Love, Medicine, and Miracles. And when I wrote to my college, Colgate, this is my sense of humor, I'm not normal. I wrote and I said, you should raise my grade from a C to a B, and then I'll have high honors. Because look what happened to me. And you know, I wrote it as a joke. I thought somebody in the office would laugh and say, sorry, you know, Dr. Siegel, we can't do that. Or some other wise comment. But anyway, I got this multiple page typed out letter, you know, on their professional stationery. And it said, we are not allowed to raise grades after graduation. So I felt sorry for them that they didn't have a sense of humor. But the reason, in a sense, it touched me is that when a patient of mine, I went to a workshop because I found it painful being a doctor. I became a doctor because I cared about people. But that's another thing I have to interrupt myself. When you say to doctors, draw yourself working as a doctor, they don't put a patient in the picture. They put equipment themselves, you know, desks that they're sitting behind, diplomas on the wall, things like that. First time I did that with 90 medical students and only had one picture with a patient in it, it blew my mind away and it helped change my course in life as a doctor. And the other was a patient of mine. We both ended up at a workshop that was to help cancer patients. Because, you know, I felt, see, most doctors are trained to treat the disease, so they don't feel bad when a patient comes in and they can't cure them. But to me, it broke my heart because I became a doctor to help people. That's what I was taught by my parents. We're here to help people. So I went to help people, and then there were a lot of people I couldn't help. And I went to this workshop to learn more ways than just medically to help people deal with troubles. And one of my patients was there. And I said to her, why are you here? Because I thought this was more for health professionals. She said, and she had cancer. She said, you're a nice guy. I feel better when I'm in the office with you. But I can't take you home with me. So I need to know how to live between offices. I can tell you that's part of what I needed too. But she became really one of my inspirations, and it changed my life because I thought, okay, I'm going to train myself to help people live between offices. And I did a lot of, you know, workshops and learned things. And then I said to my secretary, all right, send out a letter to all my patients with cancer that I'm going to start a group therapy to help them live with cancer. And I said, tell them, you know, we're not guaranteeing anything. This is about helping you to live, not just treating cancer. It's about you and your life, to help empower you. And what we've learned from other patients who became survivors when they weren't supposed to be. Boy, I thought a mob would come. So I said to my secretary, write in it, this is only for patients from our office. And she sent out a bunch of letters. And I noticed she forgot to put on it, this is only for patients from our office. And I was mad at her. I said, I'm going to be overwhelmed. What the hell am I supposed to do? And I go to the first meeting. 12 women with cancer were there. That's all. Hundreds of letters went out. 12 women with cancer show up. And when my wife came to one of the meetings to help me too, I said, look at this. And nobody shows up. And she said, honey, the ones who have showed up are exceptional women. You got to understand that. They're willing to come and work at it. Not being afraid to fail, but to participate. So the word exceptional stuck with me, and the entire group became exceptional cancer patients. ECAP. ECAP. And as the years went by, more and more men came in. But still, women were not afraid to deal with their feelings and participate. And also say things like, I can't die, you know, till they're all married and out of the house. And they were talking about their kids. And they told them, you got to live for yourself. Because what happens when all the kids leave home? Then it's okay to die. But that's part of why I bring this up. And then let me give you the other side. People... my family, my wife's family, others who have told me that they're ready to die. And I didn't argue with them. My father-in-law was in the hospital. Getting late in the day, they brought in his medications. And he said, no medications. No dinner. I knew he was saying, I'm dying tonight. And I told the nurses, and he did. See, that was the other thing that impressed me. How good people were at dying when they wanted to die. It wasn't an accident. It was their choice. You know, my wife died about 5 years ago. And yeah, that took a wallop out of my heart. Because I didn't expect it. We were sleeping. I got up early in the morning, went out. Came back to the bedroom to wake her up. After doing a few chores around the house, and took her hand, which wasn't under the covers, you know, to shake it and say, honey, wake up. And the hand was so cold, I knew she was dead. And that really gave me a zap in the heart, I'll tell you. felt like somebody connected me to electricity. Oh boy. Anyway, but I knew that she was tired. She had a lot of illnesses, neurological and otherwise, multiple sclerosis and other things, but she was just such a beauty, and she was so good at buying the messages I gave out and showing them to people. She was a teacher. You know, she'd come with me, we'd go to lectures, run workshops, and the support group as well. And she was an example. But I know she got to a point where, honey, I'm tired. And so she gave me a message that morning. And again, how nice that was. She chose to die. Didn't have to go to the hospital, spend weeks, you know, being treated or doctors doing things. And that's the way my family and her family went. They let me teach and train them. They believed in me. And nobody had trouble dying. My mother first, though, I must say, I can't remember what kind of cancer she had, but it was rather extensive. The doctors all told me what's going to happen to her, and it didn't, because she was proving her son knew how to help people with cancer. I mean, if she had died right away, I know she would have felt, oh, I let him down. She was amazing. More doctors used to come to see her, for her to teach them how to take care of patients. And finally, when she got tired and went to the hospital, she told everybody, don't think there's something wrong with me, that when my son comes, if I walk out of the room or leave him, because I can't die with my son in the room. That would be letting him down. And sure enough, one day when I was visiting her, she said, oh, I have to leave to go to the bathroom for a minute. So I went out of the room, as long as she wasn't there. When she came back and saw I wasn't there, she climbed into bed and died. And I told everybody, don't feel guilty and bad. She did it because I wasn't here and she wanted to leave. It was time. And she's not the only patient who's done that. My mother-in-law, the wonderful opera singer, who told me I wasn't allowed to sing in their house or car because of how badly I sang. But she developed cancer and did beautifully. And I knew she was tired and ready to go. So I didn't, you know, hang around the house or the hospital. So she always had her son-in-law there, and she can't get away. And I told her doctors that when I'm not with her, don't think I'm being a rude or bad son-in-law. She needs that freedom. Because they were impressed. I mean, she picked up all my messages of survival behavior, and all their predictions didn't come true. Same thing with my mother. I mean, they both had doctors who came to see them to learn what they were doing to stay alive and pass it on to other patients, you know, how to live between office visits. And my mother-in-law, again, waited till I wasn't there one day, and then she peacefully slipped away. And I told all the doctors, do you see the example? What I'm talking about. And somebody who wasn't a family member, two stories. One, hope I don't forget the other one, was about my dad. He just said to the family one day, pointing his finger at his chest and saying, I need to get rid of the pain. I need to get rid of the pain. And I told my mother, honey, he wants to die, to get out of his body and be free of this. And when she understood that, she gave him permission. You need to go? Okay. When you want to go, it's all right. And he had a very peaceful, calm, dying, because everybody knew he was uncomfortable, and he needed to leave this body, because he wasn't living in it, he was just suffering in it. And another was my mother-in-law, who also developed cancer and was in a nursing home being taken care of there. And I used to visit her regularly. I'm laughing because I used to drive her crazy. She was an opera singer in her lifetime, well known. And I would always get her to sing. And if you're an opera singer and you're now 80 years old, you don't consider yourself singing anymore. And why does your son-in-law keep driving you crazy? You don't have a voice. You're 80 years old. But I would always get her to sing, and I loved it. And boy, she was fantastic at that age. Everybody was impressed. And I used to visit her. We'd have lunch together, and I'd get her to sing in the cafeteria at the nursing home. And she would always feel embarrassed, and everybody would love her. And when I first started to take her daughter out, and she heard me sing one day, she shut all the doors and windows of the house. And I didn't know what was going on. She didn't say anything to me. And finally I asked, why do you shut all the doors and windows every time I come to take your daughter out? Because of the way you sing. I don't want my neighbors to suffer. And so I promised her I wouldn't sing anymore. And then I was allowed to take her daughter out regularly. It was amazing. But, I mean, when you know somebody who's 90 years old and they're singing still like an opera singer, which she was, it was incredible. It was so beautiful. But as long as I didn't sing in the car, in the house, it was okay. And, you know, when she got tired and felt that her voice wasn't like it used to be, she left her body. I mean, and everybody in the nursing home loved her. But this was the impressive thing. I was at religious services at a local synagogue, and I'm sitting there facing, you know, the front where the podium is, and I see the door on the left side of the, you know, like auditorium area open, and sort of a cloudy thing floated in. And I thought, that looks like somebody's spirit, the way it came in and the shape and all. And then I thought, oh my God, it's my mother-in-law. She must have died at the nursing home, and she came to say goodbye. And that's exactly what happened. She came up the aisle, paused over my head, and said, goodbye, Bernie. And then went out, like through the wall, a window, and out into the outdoors again. And I went out to see if I could see her, but she was gone. So I went to the nursing home, and as soon as I walked in the door, a nurse yelled out, oh, you must have heard. I said, I didn't hear. My mother-in-law came and said goodbye. Her death wasn't told to me. She came and let me know what had happened. And those are the things I say. What changes me? What happens? Not, you know, what I'm reading or somebody thinks they know. I just live by my experience. And I'd suggest that to all of you. They said, when my dad decided he was ready to die, he just went and did it. And I told my mother, don't feel guilty. He needs to get out of his body. It's no fun anymore. So, give him a hug and a kiss and say goodbye. And to see that as a power that is built into all of us, that's not a bad thing, to have the ability to die if you want to turn the switch off, if you will, because that frees you, keeps you from suffering. They said, like with my father, to say, I need to get out of here, and point at his chest. Oh, I have to say, the reason I learned this was my mother came and said, your father wants to get out of bed. And when I went in and he did that, you know, pointing and saying, I need to get out of here, I said, Ma, he's not trying to get out of bed. He wants to get out of his body. Because her interpretation was, I need to get out of here means I want to go outside, not be in my bedroom. And so she went and gave him permission. She took him to the hospital, had a big party. I'm sure I've talked about it here. Told everybody, Grandpa's dying today. It was a Sunday afternoon. All our neighbors, everybody that, you know, he was dying. And a big group came to say goodbye. When did he die? Our daughter. Women are never on time. Our daughter, Carolyn, was the last person in the family to walk in. She walked in the door, over to him, say goodbye, and he died. And I know he waited for all his children and grandchildren. So the death wasn't a terrible thing, you know, a horrible wound. It was the right thing to do at that time because he preferred that. He wasn't really living. He was in pain all the time. And being 91, I don't want to depress you or worry you, it's something I think about. It's tiring to be 91. So I said, I'd like to write another book. I mean, I've had things go through my head in the last, say, month or two, where, and even longer, where I could have written books if we were back when I wrote Love, Medicine, and Miracles and a bunch of the others, 20, 30 more years ago. I would have sat down with the recorder, just spieled it out, and had somebody type it. And I'm thinking of doing that now. Because I think a nice title, Love and Death. How do you put them together? And I say this. Love, this is a quote, I don't know who said it, but love is immortal and makes all things immortal, while hate dies every minute. Yes, it's one of the well-known philosophers. But love is immortal and makes all things immortal, while hate dies every minute. And I think that is so true. Love will always be in your heart.
Book of Miracles by Dr. Bernie Siegel contains inspiring stories of healing, gratitude, and love. Heartwarming and heart-opening, these stories were gathered from decades of his medical practice. The stories are riveting, warm, and demonstrate what we are capable of. They show that we can achieve miracles as we confront life's difficulties. Discover the importance of how changing from the inside out opens the door for a miracle to take place, and more, in Dr. Bernie Siegel's new book, A Book of Miracles. Get it now at Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, or your favorite bookstore. Dr. Bernie Siegel's A Book of Miracles.
What would happen if you didn't follow the established path? Would you feel scared or proud? Could you explain that helping the people of Peru improve their own community would also have an effect on your own? Would you rather make your own way or spend a lifetime saying, what if? Life is calling. How far will you go? Peace Corps. To find out more, call 1-800-424-8580 or go to peacecorps.gov.
Before you go to bed in the middle of the night when you can't sleep, or in the morning, fresh from dreams, Dr. Bernie Siegel is up ahead of you. The light is on at his writing desk. Maybe, amazingly, he's been mulling over the very same thing you've been thinking about. Introducing Words and Swords, the new series of journaling journeys with poetic thoughts by Bernie Siegel, M.D. Each of Bernie's poems is paired with space for you to express your feelings and thoughts, providing you with the opportunity for healing and growth, and to laugh a little with Dr. Bernie Siegel. Order Words and Swords now at 800-723-0336. That's 800-723-0336.
Love, Magic, and Mud Pies is a brand new book by Bernie Siegel, M.D. It helps you raise your kids to feel loved, be kind, and make a difference. Bernie, a husband of over 50 years, father of five children, and grandparent of eight, shares the gems of wisdom he has gathered from his practice and his own family life. Using his caring, comforting, down-to-earth style, Bernie's book answers parenting questions and gives you a wealth of quotes, anecdotes, and parenting tips, delivered with just the right dose of compassion, inspiration, and gentle humor. Love, Magic, and Mud Pies, an insightful, supportive, must-have guide on every aspect of parenting. Love, Magic, and Mud Pies by Bernie Siegel, M.D. is available on Amazon.com and find bookstores everywhere. Order it today. And don't forget to hear Bernie Siegel's show, Mind Health Matters, right here on HealthyLife.net.
You're listening to CHSR Real Radio on the web.
And I'll tell you something. Well, two things. One, we were just talking off microphone, and it is, I'm still living in my home that I lived with the kids, let's say at least 50 or so years, and everybody's grown up and gone now. But it's the house we moved into, and my wife had twins. We had five kids, and I wanted to keep them in the same school system, so they always had their friends. So we got a house that someone else had built, who had a lot of kids, and we had all the bedrooms we needed, and we moved in here. Oh, and we took our pets with us, that of itself should be a program I do on the benefits of pets. But let me tell you, you want to live a longer, healthier life, get some cats or dogs, or I mean it, even chickens or ducks or geese or goats. I mean, if you have something to have a relationship with, it makes a hell of a difference. I mean, now I'm getting distracted, but it's my mind just goes with the thoughts, because there's a doctor in Australia, a cardiologist. And I was traveling around, lecturing, teaching, and I saw an article of his in the paper. And he said that, you know, he thought, like Siegel, it's controversial, crazy. You know, why is having a dog help you live? But he said he began to notice that when he drove around to visit people's homes, because, as I say, in Australia, they were far apart, and it was hard for the patients to get to him, so he would go to them. He said he noticed that after heart attacks, he was a cardiologist, the people who had a dog in the house, more of them were alive for a longer period of time than those who had a heart attack and no dog in the house. And that impressed me. I wasn't doing it to not die, but I mean, we had dozens of creatures in the house. And we became, I didn't think of it that way then, but now, a rescue site, because the veterinarians would call me and say, Bernie, we have some, you know, couple that have animals and they don't want them anymore, and could you take them? And I never said no. I always said yes. Because with five kids, I had caretakers. And they each had their own interests and took care of the pets. I mean, one, our son Jeff had goats and ducks and geese, and he still does, at the house he lives in a few miles away. And it's amazing how loving and caring they were. We broke every zoning law in our town, but nobody ever reported us as breaking the law with all these crazy creatures. Everybody would call us, even the veterinarians, and say, do you mind taking one that I got such a kick out of, something closing? Would you mind taking a kinkajou? I said, what are you asking me to do? What does this have to do with religion? He said, it's not a religion, it's the name of an animal. It's a South American reptile, lives in trees and different things, and somebody didn't want it anymore because it was nocturnal. It came out at night, and they couldn't handle that. So I said, sure, bring it over. And everybody got to know that it was a kinkajou, K-I-N-K-A-J-O-U. And because I was afraid, he called the police and say, my kinkajou escaped. You know, what are they going to think I'm talking about? Anyway, he lived for many, many years and was a sweetheart. And they all became tame. They say he was nocturnal, so at night he'd be wandering around and taught him not to drive people crazy, but just to come up, sit down, rest, don't disturb us. And I'm an artist, so I painted every creature, whether it's children, people, animals, they're all hanging on the wall, and he's in it too. But just as people lived longer having a dog, I think it kept our kids milder. Tough raising the five of them, four boys and a girl, we had twins, because I kept pestering my wife, I wanted a daughter, to take care of me when I got old. It was a good choice. But anyway, you know, they were like all family. And one thing I'm sure I've told you, I can't think that I didn't tell this story here, was that because we had chickens, ducks, geese, we put them in the eggs in fish tanks that were around the house that were empty so we could see when they hatched. But what I didn't realize is they hatch and they can see us. So they thought our kids were their parents because these are all in their bedrooms in different places. And the thing that impressed me most of all and everybody at our kids' school was that all these ducks and geese and chickens imprinted on our kids. They thought they were their parents because that's who they saw when they popped out of an egg. And they used to try to go to school with them. Now, what do I mean by that? We live up a little hill, which is our like our house property, just a few acres. And our kids would go down the hill, obviously, to get on the school bus because they didn't come up to the house. We live on a circle. So the school bus would go around the circle and all the kids would come out of their houses. And one day, the ducks and geese went with our kids. They weren't penned in, so they walked right down and started hopping up on the school bus. And the bus driver looked at me like, what the hell are you doing? I told him why they did it. They thought our parents, you know, our kids are their parents. And they wanted to go with them. And the driver didn't know what to do, so he... And all the other drivers literally just used to drive with our kids, to our ducks and geese and kids to the school. And at the school, sometimes one or two of them would sneak in, but most of the time the drivers would just bring them back and let them out at the house. But everybody at the school got a kick out of it. In other words, they weren't, oh, that crazy seagull, and going after him. And the other, again, I probably was told it was a wonderful cat, Miracle. One of the kids found her in some garage somewhere. So I said, fine, bring her in. We'll adopt her, and her name is Miracle. Because somebody with cancer had just had a dream with a cat named Miracle. And this cat turned out to be a miracle. She's the most intelligent cat I've ever had. You could talk to her like a person, like one of your kids. And make a long story short, in case I told it to you before, I entered her in a dog show at our town green when some veterinarian who lives in town advertised a dog show. And when I showed up with Miracle and a dog named Furphy, he said, what are you doing here? It's a dog show. I said, she thinks she's a dog and I'm not going to disappoint her. He knew he can't deal with Siegel. He's not normal. So he didn't talk to me about it anymore. He just left us alone. And of course, she was the hit of the dog show because all the dogs came to sniff her and check her. And she had no fear of anything. I had taken her to hospitals, nursing homes, into stores where I was shopping. People would say, what are you doing bringing her in here? But she'd just sit on my shoulder and never cause trouble. So they stopped, you know, fighting with me to get her out of here. And she just was such a special, special creature. And what I loved most of all, because people gave up yelling at me and, you know, telling me I'm crazy and so forth. The next year, the vet show came up, and I saw signs all over town, you know, big signs, several feet across, and I went over and looked at them. And then I had to thank the vet, because it was a big sign, you know, sign with all the hours and days, and at the very bottom of the sign was a row of words, you know, an inch or two thick and so easy to see, painted white on the big sign. It said, for dogs only. And I knew the vet was saying, Siegel, don't show up again. You took over the show with your dog, with your cat, I mean, and we can't go through that again. So I thanked him and didn't bother him again. But it just touches people's hearts. So, yes, get a miracle. Get one. Do I get tired? Yeah, but being tired isn't as bad as being depressed. So find your breed of child and take them with you. And it's so obvious that they're feeling things that you're feeling. And I mean that literally. That, you know, they'll come to bed with you. They'll know when you're having a tough day and come and sit with you. I don't want to get you all thinking I'm crazy, but I don't mind being crazy. And I'd say your best role models are these animals. Because they do. They care about you and take care of you. And even in the car, Miracle. That's why, you know, I say Miracle. She's for the miracle. When I'm in the car and driving, if I didn't look out the front window or I turned to something in the back, she'd take her paw and, you know, give me the claw to, hey, look at out the window in the front. Not in the back of the car, not on the floor, not where the seat is. Watch the road. Yeah, she used to keep me focused. And the same thing at home. Didn't have to worry where she was. She's always taking care of somebody and something. You know, if you can just imitate, that's probably the best advice a therapist could give somebody. Act like a dog, act like a cat, you know, be that creature. My mother, I must say, was very close to being a creature. She was like that with me. I mean, if I said something was good for you, because she had cancer and other things, but all her doctors were, how come she's still alive? You know, all these parents of ours were into the 90s, and the kids' grandparents, they all had these, they were living the sermon. And I can remember my mother's doctors wanting to visit her, to learn things from her. So if she had a problem, they watched how she dealt with it. Then they could advise their patients to do that. That's why I get back over and over again. Draw yourself working as a doctor. Draw yourself taking care of people, of patients. Not writing a prescription here. This is for you. Take this pill. It's teaching them. That's why those group therapy, you know, when people were survivors, they showed you that there was a pattern to their behavior and their life. Yeah, they knew they were mortal. I mean, we all die someday, but they were examples to people. You know, they didn't focus on dying. They focused on living until they died. And the gift that that gave. And they can, I mean, it convinced me too. I mean, I thought all this was crazy. As I said, I think I used the word controversial. When I would get interviewed, oh, brother, most of the people running the shows didn't think much of me. But since I was, you know, a celebrity, they'll have them on our show. I'll tell you, I'm sure I must have said this here before. I was invited by Oprah Winfrey. I thought, oh, that's great. Well, she didn't have the same feelings I had. She wasn't inviting me because my book was wonderful. She was inviting me because my book was controversial. And I got to the studio in Chicago with some cancer patients, and sitting on the stage were a bunch of doctors, like eight of them in a row, all of whom were there to criticize me and yell at me. And I said, where do we sit? In the audience. I couldn't believe the way she treated us. I'm not saying she was, you know, evil and vicious, but, I mean, boy, she's more interested in her show than the people, than the cancer patients. If you're going to teach everybody that Siegel's crazy, then nobody's going to gain from what he's teaching. So, anyway, I sat down, and we went through the crazy sessions. And when I was invited back a second time, I let her know how I felt about, you know, being treated that way. And that didn't change her, but at least I said, that you need to notice who's helping the people in the audience. Not the doctors criticizing me, but the other patients who weren't invited, but were in the audience because they'd had lived through cancer and heard about the show and my book and everything. So eventually Oprah eased up a little, but not great enough for what I felt, especially with her popularity. Could have helped a hell of a lot of people. And then Phil Donahue called me, and I thought, oh, here I go again. Bring three cancer patients and come. And that's about all his office staff told me. So we showed up, and as I come in, I headed towards the stage, and they said, no, that's not for you. I thought, oh, here we go, another Phil Donahue day. They said, no, that's for the patients. We want the patients on the stage. Because they were in the audience before, too. They weren't celebrated for surviving. And I thought, oh, that's wonderful. And, yeah, they were up there for an hour giving a sermon and lecture to everybody about their experience. It was wonderful. And I sent Phil Donahue a little gift and a card, you know, to say, thank you. You know what I'm talking about. That was wonderful. And with time, gradually, the message got out there. you know, because even the stars get the diseases too. And I always made myself available. I wasn't trying to, you know, pat myself on the back. I was always patting my patients on the back and explaining that it was about our training that was the problem. That, and we got into drawings and showed how much a psychological perspective could portray what was best for you. You know, let me put it this way. If I say, draw yourself getting chemotherapy and you drew the devil giving you poison, we got a problem. Yeah, read my books, Love, Medicine, Miracles, The Art of Healing. Read the book, The Cancer Ward by Solzhenitsyn. When I read that years ago, I thought, oh, God, he knows what I'm talking about. He talks about cases of self-induced healing. And it was like a rainbow-colored butterfly coming out of a cocoon. Everything, the colors, the symbol, rainbow, life in order, butterfly, transformation, bust out of a cocoon. You know, you're a moth, you turn into a butterfly. That's why when my mother-in-law died, I felt she was like that. And she flew over to me from the nursing home to say goodbye. And so Solzhenitsyn, not being a doctor, but having had cancer, put the truth there right in his book. You don't read doctors doing that. Well, times have changed. I mean, I'm talking to you about decades of my doing this. But, I mean, I couldn't deny it when my patients portrayed it. So there we were. And they demonstrated what I spoke about. Then, you know, other people couldn't deny it. That's why I was impressed by Phil Donahue. He said, bring 3 cancer patients with you. I knew that was the right place to go, because they were my teachers, my coaches. You know, think about it. See, if you want to be a star baseball player, where do you learn about it? You go and you play, and you have coaches tell you what to do, how to hold the bat, how to stand, all these things. And the same is true. You're dealing with cancer. Go to a group meeting where there are not victims, but healers. Okay? I mean, they're not failures if they die. We all die. They're teaching you how to live. And then, literally, it's a medical, chemical reaction. If you're happy with your life, your body has a different chemistry than those who don't. You know, I'm always saying Monday is, and it's true, we have more heart attacks, strokes, suicides, and illnesses. Because people don't like what they're doing with their life. So Monday, oh, it's Monday again. And you suffer. On Friday, you get up, oh, feeling better. I'll have a few days off. But why not change your life and your thinking? You have to remember, the hormones in your body are created by your internal chemistry. So if you're depressed, hate life, your body does you a favor. Well, I'll try to end your life as soon as I can, so you won't suffer. But what if you won the lottery the next day? Then your body would say, oh boy, you feel different. Okay, we'll keep you going so you can enjoy winning the lottery. And I'm serious. Those are things that happen. And so keep thinking about what you enjoy, but also pay attention to what your body is feeling. You know, how are you feeling? Not what are you thinking. How are you feeling? I mean, because I wasn't a normal, and I'm not a normal doctor, the nurses used to say, why so many patients who aren't your patients want to talk to you and page you all the time, all the hospital. I said, it's because of my experience and what I'm teaching them. And that became joyful, let me tell you, because they knew, I use the term crazy, that I was a crazy doctor, and so they could page me and tell me what experiences they had. You have a transplant, and the person who died is inside you and talking to you at night when you're sleeping. But you see, I knew these things were real because the facts that were discussed and the things that happened were real in that person's life. So it wasn't something somebody was making up. And those are the things that changed me. I mean, there are a lot of other doctors who got the same information and said, oh, that patient's crazy. Oh, that can't be true. Oh, we don't want to hear that again. They'd yell at me as well as other patients because, you know, their feeling was, oh, he's making up stories. You can't trust him. But once they had something happen that verified everything I said, then it's like, how do we deny him now? The one I've often talked about is one of the physicians who had a relative die of cancer in Australia also. And when I was there, before she died, I met her. And went back there again later to lecture after she had died. And I was talking to people, you know, about her. And as crazy as it sounds, I'll just put it in these words. She showed up at my lecture in a rainbow-colored butterfly. And that was what Solzhenitsyn used to describe somebody, you know, the symbol of healing by the patient. It was as though a rainbow-colored butterfly had fluttered out of the great open book, and they all held up their foreheads and cheeks with healing touch as it flew past. Only the gloomy Padiev croaked out with a hopeless and obvious expression. I suppose for that you need to have a clear conscience. Those are all things that were written in by Solzhenitsyn, which really affected me. But I knew that when I went to Australia to lecture, yeah, a butterfly spent my entire lecture time flying over my head and the audience. Because it was outdoors, this is Australia. You can sit out there and have a lecture. And the butterfly joined us, came to our hotel with us, spent time in the hotel, and wherever I went, or my wife was with me, our butterfly kept us company, and when we left, the butterfly left. And I don't mean left with us, but went his or her way. I don't know the sex of a butterfly. And my wife and I went home. But that really impressed me. We have photographs of it. And many times since then, before my wife died, the same breed of butterfly used to show up at our home and fly up to my wife, sit on her shoulder, even come in the house. I mean, I had experiences that were just amazing. You know, because you wake up in the morning because you hear something knocking on the window, and it's in the house, the butterfly. So I open the window to let it out. But how did it get in? And why was it there? What, I knew they were all following my wife around. And, you know, she was like one of their breed. And because she's always telling stories as part of our lectures. She would get up and tell stories and often have humor in them so people would understand it's okay to laugh. You know, it's not wrong to laugh even though you have a life-threatening illness. And then, you know, when thing was over, the butterfly would fly out the door to the window and go. And I have photographs of butterflies sitting on my wife's shoulder, you know, like talking to her. And the same breed, too, was the one that used to show up in the house. It wasn't some strange butterfly. It was the same one. Ah, so that's life. Life and death. So keep living until your body tells you, I'm tired. I'm ready to go now. And you don't want to? All right, then keep going. And you have the right if you want to keep pushing to keep going. But if you're really tired, it's okay to say, all right. And then pick an event, a time, a date. I haven't picked anything for myself yet. And because I have just too many ideas going through my head. And I don't stop talking, as you can tell. But if it's in your life, let your family know. What gives it your life meaning? Why do you want to be here? So that way you don't get into conflict with your family members. Because there are times I would do things with patients and family, and our kids would think, what is he doing? Or, you know, it's crazy. And I'd make it clear to them, it's not crazy, and it's not my choice. I'm helping the person with an illness. A good way of doing that is just saying to them, how would you describe what you're going through? Okay? Not what's your diagnosis, but how would you describe what is it you're going through? And you'd be amazed. Some people, yeah, say I'm going through hell, it's hard. Others, oh, I just had a wake-up call. And they're all dealing with life-threatening illnesses. And it's part of what is my teacher. You know, I'm dealing with life-threatening illnesses, too. After my wife died, yeah, I was in the hospital and back again after I fell in the house at a dizzy spell, which I think was due to my heart rate changing, so I felt faint and fell down. And, you know, and it's not a bad idea to be a patient once in a while. Then you become a native. See, that's the other thing. Doctors, I don't think anybody should graduate from medical school without spending time in a hospital. Say, be a patient so you know what they're going through. Them. So remember, always say to people, give me a word that would describe what you're going through. And it could be anything. I'm fired from my job, I have cancer. One will say, oh, this has been a real wake-up call. And others will say, I'm in hell. You know, you have to treat them differently. So remember that. That's why when I would call the police and say, can't find my kinkajou, I often thought the police are going to say, what are you talking about? You know, that they would relate it to religion and want to arrest me for being so rude. But they learned I had a crazy creature and I was not picking on any religion. And yes, I am Jewish. I consider it a benefit. I mean, I'm not going to get into an hour of speaking about religions, but it's something to let God help you. Let the angels help you and guide you. They're all there. We're all there. Jesus' words are beautiful. So I could have a whole show on religion now. So many individuals who are teaching us. And look for common themes. This is my last statement. Look for common themes. If you find them in every religion, philosophy, and so forth, they must be working. That's why when I read Solzhenitsyn's book, he's not writing about a religion, but he's writing about the truth that he's seen in life. Okay. Bless you all.